Hello, everyone, and welcome to How to Design a No-Fail Capital Campaign. I'm Brian Saber, president of Asking Matters and author of the book Asking Styles Revolutionize Your Fundraising. And I know a bunch of you, I see your names. I know you've already got the book. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here today. I love talking about capital campaigns because they are the opportunity to really think about the future, to talk vision, talk impact, get away from a lot of the day-to-day fundraising we all have to do just to make a buck this year and keep our programs going and our facilities open. And I've always loved campaigns. And 17 years ago, I think it is, when I first met Andrea Kielstead, it was in that context. I was at Hudson Guild in New York, and we hired Andrea to be our capital campaign consultant. She and I knocked it out of the park. I learned so much from her and have done a number of campaigns since. And I always love coming back to campaigns and helping people get them off the ground. And so I'm really delighted to have Andrea and Amy Eisenstein with us today. And I'm going to come talk about them in a second, but first I want to just share some housekeeping. So hopefully you're seeing a slide on the left and a control panel on the right. If not, click on that orange and white arrow to expand that box. Two things to watch out for. One, if you're having any audio issues, often that's because of your computer. And if you toggle to phone call, you'll get a number to call in on that should clear it up. Two is the questions box. Amy and Andrea will have some questions for you, and we encourage your questions. We have a massive group today, so we may not get to them all, but please do type them in just to make sure you know where the questions box is. I'm speaking to you today from South Orange, New Jersey, where I live and work, and it would be great if you typed in where you are listening in from today. And it's always a delight to see people from all over the country and the world, so please type in where you're calling in from, and we'll get started. Wonderful. All over, some people real nearby in New Jersey and New York and as far away as Canada and Vancouver, British Columbia. Wonderful. Well, thank you everyone for joining us. One last bit of housekeeping. You will get a link to the recording of today's webinar and a copy of Amy and Andrea's slides by tomorrow. So watch out for that. And Amy and Andre are going to take it from here and also share with you this amazing new tool they've created, which I'm excited to have them bring to the market. So without further ado, I'm going to switch presenters, give the screen to Amy, and they'll be off. Amy, Andrea.
Hi there, everybody. This is Andrea speaking. I'm so excited to be here with Brian today and with Amy. As Brian told you, we met through a capital campaign many years ago, had a wonderful time doing that, then went on together to create asking the stuff about asking styles. So Brian and I have quite a wonderful history. Amy and I have also done a big project together. You might imagine that I'm a pretty collaborative kind of person because I like to work with other people. The way you may know me regarding capital campaigns is that I had the good fortune more than 20 years ago to write this big book on capital campaign strategies that work. It is now in its fourth and final edition. I do not intend to do another edition of it. On the screen here, it looks like it's a little book. It actually is a 400-page book, and you probably would be well served if you were going into a capital campaign to get it from Amazon, where they have it quite inexpensively. I'm tickled to be here with Amy, and Amy, let's turn the slide, and you and just tell. Amy lives in New Jersey, and we have had a wonderful time working together on the Capital Campaign Toolkit for almost a year and a half now. Amy, why don't you give a little about your background?
Thank you. Hi there. I'm thrilled to be with everyone today. You can see one of my books, Major Gift Fundraising, and Andrea and I have been working together, as she mentioned, for a little over a year and a half on this project on capital campaigns, but I have fairly extensive background in major gifts and campaigns, both in big and small shops. And I don't need to tell you any more about myself. I think we should just go ahead and get right started. So we're going to dive in here today. And you may be terrified by the idea of a capital campaign. And if that's the case, you are not alone. So if you're worried that you don't have enough campaign experience, or maybe you don't have any campaign experience, you can put those fears to rest, because the reality is most staff and board members who are working on campaigns have never been through a campaign from start to finish. Maybe they've been at an organization for the beginning of a campaign or the end of a campaign. But even if you've been through a full campaign, it's still a big process. So no worries there. Maybe you're worried that your organization is not ready for a capital campaign. Maybe you don't know where the big gifts are going to come from. And maybe you're worried that your board isn't a money board. But we are going to put all of those fears to rest today.
We're not actually going to make you feel like you're... we're not going to give you drugs. Let me put it that way. We're not going to give you confidence drugs, right? But we will let you know that you're not alone in feeling your anxiety. It is reasonable to be anxious when you set about raising 10 or 20 times the amount of money you've ever raised. But in all the organizations that we've worked with, we find that people learn and grow through this process. They always start out not feeling like they know enough. And they don't, because honestly, very few staff members have been through a campaign from start to finish. I don't think Brian had been through a campaign from start to finish when we did the old Hudson Guild campaign.
So yeah, not
feeling,
like that.
Right?
Yeah.
Feeling
yeah.
like you don't know enough is right. That's why you lean on books and people and coaches and consultants. You may be sure, and this probably is true, that your organization is not yet ready for a campaign. And one of the neat things to know about a campaign is that the getting ready part for a campaign is part of the campaign itself. That we know that in the getting ready is when you have your greatest opportunities to be both to learn and to pull people in. So it probably is true you're not ready for a campaign, and you're going to dive in and get ready. You may be sure you don't know the right donors. Yesterday I had a coaching call with one of my clients in California, and we were reflecting on the fact that when we first started working together, they felt like all the right donors somehow lived across town and they had no access to them, and they couldn't imagine having access. And now they feel perfectly comfortable. They've figured out how to reach out to them. So you may not know them now, but you will. You may well feel like your board isn't up to the task, and we're going to talk a lot about that in this session. If you have all of those fears, that's okay. Feel them. It's right. But guess what? You can do this. You really can do a capital campaign. If your organization has plans that are to move the needle, that are going to ratchet your organization up by doing something exciting that's going to increase your impact, if you have a project that really is going to make a difference, the chances are good that you really can have a capital campaign.
All right, so we're going to get started here with our three campaign truths that you need to succeed. So the first one is that leadership level donors are actually closer than you think. The second one is you don't need a money board to succeed. Excuse me. I had a frog in my throat. So most people are worried that if they don't have the big bucks money board, that they can't do a capital campaign. But we've found that that's not the case, and we're going to tell you why and how. And finally, we're going to talk about how well-designed and executed campaigns never fail. So we're going to go ahead and first get started with sort of an informal poll here. And Brian, we're just going to have people type in the chat box, right? Or the questions or the chat, either way.
Just have them type in the, yes, just type in the questions box.
All right. So let us know. You can just hit the number, right? I already see a number one. Where are you with your campaign? Hit a number one, two, three, or four if you're starting to think about it. Feasibility study stage. Soliciting leadership level gifts or the public phase. And I see lots and lots of answers coming in. People are all over the place in terms of where they are in the campaign. Somebody's between one and two, lots of feasibility studies, lots of soliciting leadership level gifts. But I think mostly starting to think about it, just getting started. I got somebody typing, hi, it went by so fast, I don't know who it was. But
hi, Nancy. Nancy. Hi there, Nancy.
Oh. Okay. So good. You know what? I think we have people mostly in the one, two, and three, lots of threes, actually, probably not so many fours. I only saw a few fours. All right, so let's go ahead and get started. Excellent. Andrea, take it away.
So truth number one, leadership level donors are closer than you think right now. So I'm going to start by telling you a story, which is of a campaign I worked on some years ago. It was for a private school, and they hired me to be their consultant. I'm not doing full-on campaign consulting anymore, but in that time in my career, I was. And I went in to talk to the development director, and I found out what the school was planning to do. It was a solid and a good project. And I said to her, okay, you know, how are you getting ready for this campaign? And she told me that she had been spending hours and hours and hours at the Foundation Center. They're her local Foundation Center. And how excited she was, because as she looked to see the donors who gave really big money to private schools, to private secondary schools, there were a lot of them. So she was perfectly convinced that the way for her to find major donors was to be sending out inquiries from the lists of people and foundations and donors that she had gotten through the Foundation Center. Now, the school that she was a part of actually was, you know, what I would call, maybe this is an old-fashioned phrase, a crunchy granola school. You know, it wasn't fancy. Right, it wasn't the kind of school you would see in a fancy suburb. This was a school where parents didn't show their wealth, right? And it was sort of wasn't acceptable, the culture of the place. And if you're in an academic community like Ithaca, for example, this is standard. Showing your wealth in trappings of wealth sort of isn't approved of in some communities. And the school this woman worked for was like that. So somehow she was quite convinced that there wasn't any wealth, and that to the extent there was wealth, because these people had to pay big tuition bills, it meant that all their money was gone and that there weren't likely to be major donors. So she spent a huge amount of time in the Foundation Center and did her research and started sending letters. And guess what happened? After a while, she started going to the mailbox and slide, Amy.
Sorry.
Empty. Nothing. The things she got back were, we're not interested. She had lost track of the fact that the donors to her project, and honestly, the donors to all of your projects, are close at hand. They are in your community already for one reason or another. Either they are already donors to your project, or they are major donors in your community who for some reason have an interest in helping your organization rise to the next level. Let me just spend a minute on that, because there are many community-based organizations that don't get big gifts from the largest donors in town, but the largest donors in town think that organization is important, right? And they would like to see the organization grow to the next level. So while they might not want to serve on the board, and they might not want to be giving year after year after year at large levels, when the organization is ready to take a step forward, those donors might well get on board for a capital campaign. So lesson number one, really, and lesson number one is that don't assume that just because the culture of your organization doesn't show wealth, people aren't wearing diamonds and furs and, you know, looking fancy. Don't assume that there isn't money right under your nose.
Yeah. So just to follow up on Andrea's point, you know, for the right project, many donors can give at least 10 times more than they might be giving to your organization right now. I'm going to use myself as an example. I actually give to, as you imagine, in my line of work, I work with hundreds and some years thousands of nonprofit organizations, but I give low-level amounts to lots of organizations. I give $25, $50, $100 here and there. But when an organization I really care about comes and sits down with me, if they ask me for 10 times what I had been giving them, I could pretty easily do it without thinking much about it. Now, I have to tell you, this is true for all levels of donors. Your biggest campaign donors do the exact same thing, so that when they're giving to an annual fund, when they're responding to a mail appeal, or when they're showing up for your events, or they're giving through other vehicles online and such, they are not giving anywhere near what they could be giving. It's also true even if you've asked them for a major gift. What happens is that donors step up like never before during a campaign because there's a really compelling case for support. So I just gave you an example of my low-level giving, but you know, if anybody asked me for $1,000, I could definitely do it. I certainly give some organizations that, but if somebody came and sat down with me, I would easily give them 10 or 20 times what I have been giving them. And not only that, if they ask me for a campaign gift, if they ask me for 5 years in a row, I could make a $5,000 gift. And if somebody, you know, just like me, can do that kind of gift, just think about what kind of gifts that your donors can make. And it really is what happens in campaigns. So you may not know that you have any big donors in your database right now or in your community, but when campaigns roll around, they really rise to the occasion, and we see it again and again and again.
You know, I'll give you another story, a quick story this time. I was involved some years ago with an organization, a founders organization. A guy came to me and said he wanted to create a science, what he called a science factory, a place where kids could go and have fun and learn about science, like in this picture. He had really no nonprofit experience. He had never been much involved in fundraising. And obviously, because he was founding the organization, he had no donors. So how did he find donors, right? Well, of course, what he did was he went to people he knew, people who already had a connection with him. And he started talking to them about this project, and some percentage of them had a reason to be interested in his concept. And as he found out what those reasons were, as he began to understand donors' motivations, then he built his major donor pool. Now that's starting from absolutely nothing. And those of you on this session are probably not starting from absolutely nothing. But what my friend Jim, who founded this organization, learned is that his donors were close at hand, even though he started out not believing that, right? That was a learning experience for him. So your donors are always close at hand.
Yeah, so the question is, where can you find leadership level donors for your campaign? And they really are closer than you think. So, of course, your first go-to donors are your existing leadership level donors. So anybody who's already giving you major gifts or already giving you your largest donations, their current donors who are qualified. That's the next pool of people that you're going to go to, even your low-level donors, but current donors who are qualified, and philanthropic leaders in your community. So I have to tell you that whenever we start working with organizations, you know, truth number one, leadership level donors are closer than you think. That's truth number one. But what I was going to say is when we start working with organizations, frequently staff and volunteers call consultants and say, you know, help me find donors. We need to find major gift donors or campaign donors. And the reality is that your best donors are not out there, but they're close to your organization. They're in the community. They're part of your community. And all communities have leadership donors. Now, they may not have given to your organization yet, as Andrea said, but once you start a campaign, If you are at a well-respected organization in your community, it's likely that they've heard of you and maybe just waiting for the occasion to really step up. All right, so let's go ahead and move on to truth number two. Truth number two is you don't need a money board to be successful. And listen, your board, unless you have a money board, which probably many of you are thinking we don't, your board isn't the group of people that are really going to lead your campaign. A campaign committee is the ones are the ones who are going to do that. And that's why we say that you don't need a money board to be successful in a capital campaign. Board members do have to be supportive and serve as good advocates and get behind your campaign and make gifts. They each need to make their own gifts. But it's your campaign committee that will really lead your campaign.
So as you get ready for a campaign, it really is time to build a fully committed board. And it's not uncommon, actually, as an organization starts to move into a campaign, starts to move towards a really big project, for one or two board members to decide that would be a good time to step away. If you're lucky, the people who will be stepping away are the board members you had always wished would step away, right? There are most boards, in my experience, there are a couple people that you would be very happy if they said, all right, I think I'm out of here. When you have empty board seats as you're getting ready for a campaign, it gives you an opportunity to bring in some new blood, some people who will be excited about the new growth and the new way forward. And as you get ready for your campaign, that's what you need to be working on, getting a group of people who are really totally committed and excited about your project. And until you have that, I would slow down. I would spend a fair amount of time actually working to build that kind of interest and excitement in your board, because you don't want to be in a position where your board members are going and talking to people they know and saying, well, you know, I'm on this board, but I don't really think they're doing this big project. I don't really think they can achieve it. So full commitment on part of your board is critically important. Now, I have another story for you. You will want to leverage your board strengths, and that's why they all need to be committed. So years ago, I worked for a small daycare center. I'm a sucker for little campaigns. I like them. I actually do. Some consultants shy away from them, but for bigger ones, I don't like the politics of big organizations. By and large, I find that little organizations are just exciting and full of energy and commitment. So I worked for a little daycare center. It was a small daycare center in a poor neighborhood in a mid-sized community. And as you would imagine, the board members were, for the most part, people who had kids who had kids in the daycare center, right? That's what you'd imagine. Now, some of the people who were on that board were grandparents. And of course, some of the people who were on the board had parents who knew people in the community. So rather than, you know, crying in their soup about the fact that they didn't have any power, what they thought of as power or wealth on their board, they got some of these grandparents together and they said, all right, we're going to look at the lists of major donors in our community and we're going to see who you're connected to. Who's friends with these people? Who goes to the same country club? Who connects with them? And by golly, they use those grandparents in the most effective and remarkable way to build a campaign committee for that small daycare center that involved some of the major donors and the major philanthropic leaders in their community. And they did it using the people who were on their board or the relatives who were of the people who were on their board. Now, what I loved about that, actually, is that having those conversations, right, getting those people together in their little daycare center and saying, all right, who do we actually know? Where do we have connections? Who can go and talk to Mr. Shank? I remember to this day, one of the largest donors, his name was Mr. Willis Schenck was his name. Who knows Willis Schenck? And of course, it turned out someone's mother knew Willis Schenck. They were friends, childhood friends. So they used their board to build a real powerhouse campaign committee. And you better believe that campaign was successful.
Yeah, so we're going to circle back to truth number two, that you don't need a money board. But I'll just tell you quickly, just to reiterate some of Andrea's points. I was once facilitating a board retreat several years ago now for a chapter of Big Brothers Big Sisters. And, you know, we were starting to talk about 100% participation. Everybody needed to be on board in terms of their giving before we even thought about embarking on a campaign. And the executive director and a few of the key board leaders were so nervous that I was going to offend some of the existing board members. But they trusted me. We went ahead. We did the retreat. We talked about the importance of leading by example at whatever level worked for your own personal family budget. And at the end of the day, two board members stepped off the board. And, you know, at first, this was a worry. Everybody was all worried that we were going to offend people. Well, they weren't really offended, but they realized that this wasn't where they should be at this time. And the staff and some of the key active board members were actually relieved, because those were the board members that weren't serving the organization in any way. So the board members that stepped off, everybody was relieved that they were gone. And two other board members who hadn't been contributing financially really got on board, and they wrote checks. So they weren't leadership level checks, but they understood that they had to be part of the team if they were going to be on this board going into a campaign. And so, listen, board members do need to understand their roles in the campaign, but that doesn't mean they need to be a money board to do that. But you do need a campaign committee that has the capacity to make leadership level gifts, but they don't need to be people on your board. That's part of the campaign process. So that's truth number two, is that you don't need a money board to be successful in your capital campaign.
You know, let me just add one more thing to this, Amy, about money boards. I go back and forth with my colleague, Paula Peter, who has been in this capital campaign business about as long as I have. And the question comes up again and again, well, what percentage of your campaign goal should the board contribute? Right? I get that question often. And my answer generally is there is not one pat answer. If your board is not made of people who have wealth, it makes no sense for you to say 20% of the campaign goal should come from your board. But if your board has been constituted like the Metropolitan Opera's board or some of these big institutions, fancy institutions, if your board has been constituted to have people because of their wealth and other things, then maybe the board would give 80%. So what percentage of money should come from your board? You know, it depends on what kind of a board you have. My friend Paula Peter believes that every board and the steering committee together should give at least 20% of the campaign goal. And when you add the steering committee to it, I'm sure she's right. So that just gives you a little frame for how much your board might give. Okay. Truth number three, well-designed and executed capital campaigns never fail. Now, I don't know, Amy, this is a funny slide. Go back to that slide for a minute, right? Doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He looks sleazy, right? this looks like a truth you wouldn't, you know, you're somebody's pulling the wool over my eyes to do this. Anyway, it is true that well-designed and executed campaigns never fail.
All right, we'll get into that, but why don't we just do one more quick survey of everybody? All right, so again, I think in the questions box, How much do you hope to raise? What's your working goal? So number one is under $1 million. Two is 1 to 5 million. Three is 5 to 10 million. And four is over 10 million.
And Amy, while you're waiting for those results, we got a question from Tony. How do actually for Andrea too. How do you address long-serving board members who have been through many campaigns and will give but aren't enthusiastic, right? So you have people who don't want to give and maybe through this process they leave. What about those who will give but really aren't enthusiastic? They've been through it before. Any thoughts?
Andrea, you want to take this one?
Sure. The question is, what is it they're not enthusiastic about? Right? If they're not enthusiastic about the project, if they don't think you should be doing this forward growth, whatever it is, I'd spend some time getting to the bottom of that. If they're not enthusiastic about the campaign because they've been through too many of them and they're tired, then you might give them a way out, a graceful way out. Maybe you make them honorary something. So find out what they're, what is causing them to be not so enthusiastic. And these days, it's very much on my mind that when you sniff a problem, when you feel that there's a problem, you shouldn't just run right through it. You should spend some time exploring it. Because mostly in the exploring of the problem, the solution will emerge.
Yeah. Tony actually explained further that that they serve on many boards, and of course that's a challenge in many ways. I almost call them professional board members who think they're doing the right thing by sitting on 6 or 8 boards, but then they're spread too thin to be making a critical difference at one or the other.
Yeah.
You find that?
I mean, I think we do find it, but what I like to say to board members is that during the course of this campaign, we hope that you will focus your attention for the next 3 years, and we'll actually get to the campaign timeline in just a second, and make this organization your first or second top charitable priority. Just for the duration of the campaign. And then, of course, at the end of the campaign, if you spread yourself, then again, it makes sense. But if you can't do that, if we still, even during a campaign, aren't your top first or second priority in terms of your philanthropic giving and your time commitment and attention, then we do have an issue. What would you say to that, Andrea?
I don't know. You know, I tend to be nasty these days.
Yeah.
I tend to toe a harder line and to say, listen, you know, if you can't get behind this campaign, we certainly hope you'll give. But, you know, but it's dangerous really for us to have a major donor who is someone long time affected who was just too busy doing other things. So I tend to put things out there, but that's just because I'm old. Something like that.
I think it's because you're wise, Andrea. So,
listen, there is a question here that we should answer because everybody always asks it. And then we're going to go back to our content. The question is, how do we keep the campaign from cannibalizing our annual fund? Right? This is a question. This is probably the question I get more often than any other single question. So let me see if I can address it. Here's what I hope is a really clear answer. You must set up your campaign so that it does not cannibalize your annual fund. It's really that simple in a way. Every time you talk to a donor about a campaign gift, you must make it very clear that that campaign gift is over and above their annual fund gift. And if they can only make one gift, you have to keep the annual fund going. So you have to make it as clear and explicit as possible. What you will find is that most people who give to your annual fund are willing to give a special gift for a certain period of time over and above that. But if you don't make it clear, people are going to say to you, well, this year I'll give to the campaign instead of the annual fund. It even needs to be in your campaign policies. right? That this is over and above. It's one of the reasons I don't like these comprehensive campaigns where they lump everything together. That invites, in my opinion, invites problems. But I'm sure that statement will raise a lot of eyebrows, but we don't have time to talk more about it now.
Yeah, well, I'll just give a quick example of how you can do, make sure that it doesn't cannibalize. And Andrea, obviously you said, you know, put it in your campaign policies. You want to talk about it in all of your communications and on your website. But when you're sitting down with a donor to ask for a campaign gift, I always encourage or insist that anybody I'm working with does what I call a double ask. I don't know if that's a technical term or not, or if I just made it up. But, you know, we say, let's say you're going to talk to somebody who's been consistently giving $1,000 to your annual fund. So you might ask that person for $15,000 over 3 years, so $5,000 a year. And what I would explain to them is that we would like to use $1,000 a year to continue and maintain the annual fund and $4,000 a year for the campaign. And so really the campaign gift is $12,000 and they've maintained their annual fund contribution of $1,000 a year. So that's just to illustrate the point even more. All right, shall we continue?
Yep.
All right,
mosey along here.
You know, it's good to see we have a really wide range of campaigns here based on this poll question. We have campaigns under a million, between 1 and 10 million, and over 10 million. So I think it's quite, we have quite the spread here. So let's look at a campaign timeline. And this is a really basic campaign timeline. And depending on how quickly you go through each phase, it may take 2 to 3 years, you know, 24 to 36 months. And we start at phase one with pre-campaign planning and then work into the feasibility study in phase two and on down the line here. Listen, what we're gonna talk about in this truth number three, and I'm gonna let Andrea explain it in just a minute, is how well-designed and executed is an important point, but how well-designed campaigns never fail. And that's because consultants know to build in 2 fail-safe checkpoints to test and revise the working goal before ever announcing the official goal in public. So let me let Andrea get into that.
Sure. So when we begin a campaign in this pre-campaign planning phase, way over to the left here, we always like to use the phrase working goal. It's like a draft. I mean, at one point when I was teaching the capital campaign course at the fundraising school, I would have, you know, like 30 people in my course for 3 days. And at the end, I decided I was going to give them a graduation present. So I went to the local office supply store and I bought a draft stamp for every student. That's what they got as their graduation present. Because in the early parts of a campaign, you're working with drafts, draft case for support, draft goal, right? A working goal. It is all fluid and flexible. And because it's fluid and flexible, because your goal is fluid and flexible, you want to start with a high goal. You want to think about what is it that if we could raise this money, then we could really achieve something significant. That's where you want to begin. Because if you start with low expectations, that's what you're going to draw. So in this pre-campaign planning phase, you're going to say, all right, we want to raise $10 million or whatever is big for you, $20 million. We're just going to take a deep breath. We're going to get over our fear. We're going to say, if we could raise this much money, we really could, we could have a far greater impact, and here's how we would do it. So you get your committee sort of wrestling with that. You put together your gift range chart that way, and then you hire a feasibility study consultant. The consultant, and there, we could have a whole session on just that, but your consultant goes out, interviews people, and they come back to you and say, you know what, people love this project, they love your organization, but we don't see that you can raise $10 million. We can only identify enough leadership gifts so that we think you should go for $6 million. All right, well, that's your first correction point. Your working goal, which you were testing, now has hit a little hitch. And your committee may have a lot of courage and may say, all right, we hear the consultant, we're going to go for $8 million. We're not going to listen to the $6 million stuff. We can pare back our plans to $8 million. We can still make it happen. So you've gone from $10 million to $8 million. Then you go through the campaign planning and the quiet phase, this leadership gift phase. That's where you ask for the largest campaigns. That's number four here in that whole big phase. You're asking for the largest gifts on your $8 million campaign. And as you get close to number five here, your campaign kickoff, you realize that, you know what, the consultants were really wrong because you tied down the larger gifts than you ever thought. So in fact, you don't have to pull back to 8 million. You can go for the whole 10 million yard campaign. So you up your goal, or you may have missed on the largest gifts, and then you lower your goal. During that entire phase of the campaign, you've been using a working goal. You have not announced it in the newspaper. You have not announced it in the press. You have not created fancy campaign brochures that are spelling out your campaign goal. You're working with drafts, and you work with drafts to solicit those largest gifts. For many people, this seems counterintuitive, but believe me, it works well. Then, by the time you get to the campaign kickoff, you have a pretty good idea what it is you can raise, and then you start trumpeting. All right, our campaign really is going to have a campaign goal of $10 million. You know where that money is. A bunch of it's been committed. Maybe 65% of it's been committed. And then you can go public. You can really start rattling everybody's cages and making a lot of noise. And lo and behold, your campaign is going to be successful. With those two fail-safe points where you can raise or lower the goal, if you do that right, your campaign will succeed. Not because the first number was necessarily the right one, but because you kept things quiet enough and flexible enough, and you talked to your donors in a way that they understood that, so that by the end, your organization can walk out with its head held high, even if the goal was a little lower or a little higher than you set out to raise. Amy, did that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And I just want to say that to anybody who feels like it's cheating to change your campaign goal sort of midway through or twice through, you know, it's really not. This is actually how campaigns work and how campaigns succeed. Now, does it mean that you're going to be able to raise all the money you want to for your dream project? No, maybe you won't be able to. Sometimes organizations do have to scale back their construction plans or their projects, but it does mean that you run a successful campaign. And it's really important for future contributions that you look like you're an organization that runs really successful fundraising campaigns. And you achieve what you can and you build what you can. And then you move on. But this way, your campaign is well designed, well executed, and your campaign goal is a success. Your campaign does not fail. Andrea, anything to add before we move on?
No, but Amy, we have to change this picture. You know, it reminds me of that awful guy in the rental car ad, you know, whatever that is, right? He looks so sleazy.
All right. No more of that guy. All right. Those are the three campaign truths that you need to succeed. First, of course, is leadership level donors are closer than you think. And I think this is a really important one because it's a huge fear of nonprofits that are going into campaigns that they really don't have the leadership level donors that they will need. They don't know where they're coming from, but they're always closer than you think. The second is you don't need a money board to succeed. You do need a campaign committee, but your board doesn't need to be a money board. And truth number three is that well-designed and executed campaigns never fail. So, Andrea, you want to talk a bit for just a quick second about what we've created?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. I just want to reflect for a minute, Amy, on our three truths, though,
okay.
which is to say that, you know, when you have been in a business, any business, for a long time, and you start to internalize how something works, it makes you able to take very complicated subjects and weed them into simple things. These three truths look really simple. And I hope they feel to you to be really simple. The reality is that embedded in these three truths are powerful and important and really complex ideas about how capital campaigns work. So to the extent we've been successful in clearly and simply explaining this to you, don't be fooled. These are really profound topics as they relate to most every campaign, whether it's a small campaign or a giant campaign. These things are apply to all of them. So I just want to sort of say these matter. These concepts are what it is you need to know. Now, Amy, let's talk about the toolkit.
Yeah, so we'll answer questions in just a minute. So if you have questions, now's your chance to type them in.
Yes, so Amy and I have spent a year and a half now, I think, creating the first comprehensive online capital campaign resource that there is. We got together and decided that it would be a good idea quite some time ago. I said to Amy, gee, I think we should do this. She said, I'm in, let's make it happen. And we have created a clear and well put together and user-friendly online resource that gives you a step-by-step system with downloadable worksheets and samples that you can take and copy and paste and adapt for your organization. We've divided the campaign into the seven phases that you can see here. Each phase has a step-by-step guide. Each step-by-step guide has under each step, it explains what each step is, and within each step, it has a set of material that you'll need for that step. All of the material is not like my book, which you have to sit and read for hours and hours. This is stripped down, clean, simple. They are Word documents or Excel spreadsheets, so that you don't have to recreate things. You just copy them, cut them, paste them, and adapt them to fit your situation. I'm tremendously proud of it, Amy. I think we just did it took us a lot of thinking, a lot of work, but I think we really have provided something that's sort of akin to legal Zoom. Is that what it's called?
Why am I not remember?
Right? I mean, if you think about how much expert information you are getting online these days, we've taken that concept and applied it to capital campaigns. So you may still need a campaign consultant or a campaign coach, but this gives you at your fingertips the tools you need to do a capital campaign. We have made a nice chunk of this available to you for free. If you go to capitalcampaigntoolkit.com, you will then have to click whether you're a consultant or an organization, because we have sites for both consultants and organizations. If you're you will get the entire stripped down step by step checklist. You won't get the steps themselves or the Word documents or the samples. You won't get agendas. You won't get, you know, job descriptions. You won't get those sorts of things inside, but you'll have a very good guide to what to do for your capital campaign. I'm proud of us, Amy.
Yeah, so let's go to questions.
Okay. Why don't I take back the screen? And just before we go to questions, I'd like to just share a couple of things that are coming up at Asking Matters. One second, let's put that back up. Here we go. So while you're typing in your questions, we've got some wonderful programs coming up in October, all free. From the 9th to the 17th, I'm going to be running my Don't Ask, Don't Get fundraising workshop. It's a four-part webinar series, free to everyone. It's going to teach you lots of the basics and important pieces of asking. After that, I'll open my membership at Asking Matters, and you get information on that. But the workshop is completely free. On October 5th, Sandy, 25th, Sandy Reese is joining us as our next fundraising master to talk about the Newbie's Guide to Asking for Money. And some of you who are in that first stage or are new to your organization might be interested in that in particular. And on October 31st, we're going to have some fun. Jay Frost, another of our peers in the field, he and I have long talked about how serious we are in fundraising. And we have decided on Halloween to share our fundraising horror stories and to encourage them from others. So we're going to be asking some of our peers to provide them. And we'll ask you to come listen in with your favorite Halloween candy and maybe share a story or two. So all that's coming up in October. And now to take some questions. And I saw one in particular, Andrea and Amy, which I thought was really important because we talked a lot about community or local organizations that have a base or a network there. What about organizations that are working in another country, let's say, and they have small groups here and there around the States and Canada or wherever? How do you galvanize support when your supporters are spread out, and how do you find those gifts?
That's a tough question. Those are tough organizations to do capital campaigns for. It is possible, but it's hard. You have to work like mad to identify the people who are spread out and to find a way to bring them together, either virtually or in person. I've worked, actually done a fair amount of work over sometime coaching a woman who has raised a significant amount of money for a home for unwanted children in the northern corner of India, right in the foothills of the mountains there. And you just have to do the work of finding out who's who, of doing the research to find out who's involved in your organization, no matter where they are, of giving them opportunities to come together. You have to build a head of steam, and you have to build it in a way that is not just a little pickings, but that shapes the larger project. So it takes more time, it takes more energy, it takes more effort to do that, but it is possible.
And I would just add that with technology and video chat, honestly, it's getting easier and easier. There are all kinds of tools and apps and resources that help committees stay together when they're not in the same state or the same time zone. People can see each other as they're participating in meetings all around the world. So I actually think, you know, when we say find people in your community, to me that extends past geography and to people who care about your cause.
Yes, I also think that the more stuff we do virtually, the more exciting it is to actually come together in person. So you can, I think, and should be using all of the possibilities here. Nancy Montvides is on this call from Seroptimists International. Nancy, I bet you'd have some interesting things to say because they are a big international organization and have been working on a campaign. So I'm afraid I can't give you the floor, Nancy, but you might want to look into this Seroptimists campaign. There are a number of questions here that I see that I'd like to answer. One is, does it confuse major donors if the goal you told them changes? And I don't think it confuses them, but you need to be talking to them, right? You don't want to surprise them. You need to be, when you're going to have a major goal change, you want to cycle back to them and say, this is what's happening. These are the consequences. This is what we're doing. And this is what's going to work. For the most part, people are very happy to be part of that conversation and to know that you're remembering to circle back to them. How late is too late to scale back on the size of the goal? Well, ideally, you don't want to scale back on the size of the goal after you've announced it publicly, right? Then you're moving into the direction of failure, and you really don't want to fail. Now, sometimes that's not so easy. Sometimes you have to scale back or extend the time frame. If you've announced a big goal and you're nowhere near there, you have to either say this is the first phase and we're going to have a second phase, or you're going to say we're going to keep on working on our leadership, our leader donors. You have the goal to work on and the timetable to work on. So, but earlier than announcing is better. So why, and this is the last one, and then I'll kick it back to you, Brian. Why use drafts to solicit largest gifts? I love this question. You know, ideally with your largest donors, you want them to be partners, not pockets. That's Gail Perry's phrase, and I've always loved it. You want them to be partners in your project. To the extent that you are presenting them finished, fancy material, you are only talking to them about money. You're no longer able to say to them, tell us what you think, in an authentic sort of way. Donors, and the largest donors particularly, want to be able to give you their opinions and advice. And ideally, they want you to take some of it, not all of it, but some of it. So when you're using drafts to solicit the largest gifts, you have a real genuine opportunity to do that. And I think that's a very important part of major gifts fundraising.
Great. Well, we do have tons of questions. One popped up, which I thought would be particularly interesting for Amy, from Lori, asking, how do we as a very small nonprofit make time for capital campaign? And I direct this to Amy because one of Amy's books is 50 Asks in 50 Weeks, which is all about making time for major gifts. And I love that book. So take that one step further, Amy. So you know, we have lots of organizations on with a staff person, if that.
Yeah.
How are they going to start this?
So it always makes me smile and sort of sad when an organization comes to me and says, you know, we've been raising $100,000 annually, and now we need to raise $1 million for the next 3 years because we're in a $3 million campaign. And yet they have no plans or intentions to hire any staff or consultants or use any resources. And you know, it's just crazy. And so, you know, on the one hand, yes, it's true. There needs to be some shifting of roles and responsibilities. The executive director is going to need to get involved and engaged in the campaign process. So is the development director. But the idea that you could go from raising $100,000 a year to $500,000 a year or $1 million a year with no additional staff or help, to me, is just nuts. And so the important thing for a small organization, any size organization, is to be realistic in terms of your budgeting, both of your financial resources, but also of your time. So, you know, you may not hire more fundraising staff per se, but maybe you hire more administrative staff, so that you can offload some of the development director's responsibilities so that they do have more time to focus on the campaign, but they do have support staff in place. So I'm not saying that you always have to hire more fundraising staff, but you may need to subcontract things out. You may need to have a consultant. You may need to have administrative staff. But when it's a priority, people say, okay, for the next 3 years, we need everybody's time and attention on this.
Great. Thank you, Amy. And here's an interesting question from Mary. How would you contrast a campaign steering committee's job description or individual members' job descriptions from those of board members?
There's a big difference, but Andrea, go ahead.
I don't know, Amy, you take that.
All right. Okay. So listen, the board is there and is responsible for governance, ongoing governance, policy, vision of your organization as a whole. The campaign committee is there to drive the campaign, but they're not going to be doing the governance. They're not going to be responsible for hiring and firing the executive director. They're not responsible for they don't have fiduciary responsibilities for the organization. They're there to drive the campaign. It's a totally separate role. I don't, you know, you will have some board members serving on the campaign committee, but I don't see any real conflict or overlap in terms of their responsibilities. The campaign committee is not going to take over the board roles and responsibilities.
I'd add one thing there, and that is, you know, almost every organization is challenged getting its board to actively fundraise, right? And when we set out for a campaign, we try and bump that up and get everyone involved, and some do better than others. The campaign steering committee, I mean, there are various committees, and the committee that's really moving this ahead has to have some askers on it, or you're going to be left with the staff doing all of the asks, and there are a lot of asks to be done in the campaign. So I think it's even more imperative, and tell me, Amy and Andrea, what you think, that campaign steering committee have people who willingly and ably will get out and ask.
Right. I think that's right.
Yeah.
it can't be people managing, right? It's easy to, I shouldn't say easy, but it's easier to manage something and give some direction and say, yes, this is going in the right direction, let's move it in a different direction, than it is to get out there and walk the walk. And you must have that in a campaign committee, I find, to move ahead.
Yeah. So, Brian, yes. I see that it's 3 o'clock.
I'm
willing to stay on for a few more minutes if other people are. Do you want to answer just a few more questions, or should we call it quits?
Why don't we take two? Because there are so many questions coming in, and this is such an important topic. Let's just take two more, and then we'll call it quits, and people can reach out to any of us after that.
There is one person, Kathy Holt, has asked about doing an informal feasibility study, about not using a consultant, and I do have a lot of thoughts about that. Kathy, I would encourage you to go to my other website, capitalcampaignmasters.com, and in the blog, do a search under feasibility studies. And yeah, I've written some pieces, some blog posts about that. And I'm actually experimenting with it in the field at the moment. I'm a believer in changing that model, but it's complicated.
Are you? Andrea, that's so interesting, because I was just about to say that if I learned one thing from you, and I have learned thousands of things, but it is that I would never do a campaign without a feasibility study.
Yes.
I wouldn't consult with one who wouldn't do one, because that was the biggest eye opener for me when we worked together at Hudson Guild. In so many ways, that study was so important. So tell us why are you thinking of changing the model?
Yeah, I'll tell you briefly. I mean, I do believe in feasibility studies. I really do. And also, I believe that the relationships with the major donors should be between the head of the institution and the major donors. That the more attention we give to that, the more nudging we give to the executive director or the head of the organization to actually be talking in a real way to the major donors, the better. So I think there is some opportunity to include some of those conversations with the institutional leadership and the major donors, and bring in a consultant to do some of the stuff that is best done by an outsider. Yes. So I'm not suggesting we don't do them. I'm suggesting that we have a more complex model that actually puts the relationship where it should be. Then it's not easy, and it's not simple, and a new model is not simple, and people get angry with me for even exploring it. But I think it's a ripe subject. So check out Capital Campaign Masters. Check out the blog. You can find a bunch of articles on it there.
Excellent. And Tracy asked, how do you get a feasibility study? I'm sure if you searched online, you'd actually find some samples. They're often between 10 and 15 questions. Sometimes they get much more in depth than that, but they're really digging in to what your key supporters, the people who believe in you most, are thinking about your organization today on all levels, not just what it can raise and what it should raise it for, but what's the strength of the staff. How does it seem fiscally? Does it seem fiscally responsible? Does it seem strong enough to do this? What does it think of leadership and so forth? And it's very revealing whoever is doing it. Excellent opportunity. Yeah, Amy?
Brian, let me jump in for 1 second. You know, I think it's interesting that you said that you might find some feasibility studies samples online, and you might. There's everything online these days. But I would say that you also might not, because One of the things, one of the reasons Andrea and I put together was this capital campaign toolkit is because traditionally all of these campaign resources have been closely held by consultants who don't want to share them because they don't want to be put out of work. Now, we've put all sorts of resources like how to do a feasibility study and the questions to ask in the toolkit. Now, we're not saying that the toolkit replaces using a consultant, but we think of it more as an a la carte model where you can use a consultant where and when you think you need one because you have all the tools and resources at your fingertips and you can decide what your staff is capable of handling and when you actually need to call in some expertise. So I just thought it was interesting. Yes. But you said that. I'm going to Google.
I was going to do that too at the same exact time. And I didn't mean to be a shill for Amy and set her up for that wonderful answer. But actually, the toolkit is fabulous. I have been in it, going through it, and it's a brilliant, brilliant product. I hope you will all look at it. I really will be recommending it a lot. So, we are over the hour. Thank you, Amy and Andrea, as always, for coming and being part of the Ask a Matters community and sharing all this great information. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And we'll be following up with you in all sorts of ways. Good luck with your campaigns wherever you're at with them. Thank you all.
Thank you, everybody. Girl.